The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
Vogue and glamour move over. In Afghanistan, women now have a magazine of their own. It covers everything from nail polish to news.
I think my proudest story is the one I did on teenage women prisoners who were being raped by their guards. They were going into prison as single women and coming out with babies.
And a tale of noisy livestock in West Africa.
They're not pets. They're food, work tools, and financial assets. But for me, they were a giant pain in the tuchus.
And musician Ruben Blades, singing about Latino life on the streets.
In their streets, death and life dance together, holding a can of beer in their hands.
Around the world, with the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. After the Haiti earthquake, there was some talk about moving Port-au-Prince to a different location, starting the city over from scratch. Some people even suggested relocating New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Of course, nothing came of those suggestions. But in Mexico, officials have actually done it. After a massive flood devastated a town in Chiapas, the government decided not to rebuild it. Instead, they built a completely new town in a new location. It's called Nueva Juan del Grijalva, and it came with ready-made jobs, schools, and services. It's been less than a year since villagers moved into the prefab town, and we're going to take you there in a moment. But first, reporter Grant Fuller joins us to talk about the project. Grant, welcome to the show. You know, after a disaster, communities usually rebuild right where they are. Why didn't that happen in this case?
Well, for one thing, the community of Juan del Grijalva was in a very risky zone. It was built alongside of a river. Basically, their entire community was washed away, so they had nowhere. They couldn't rebuild in the same spot because their land on which it was built had washed into the river. They called it a river tsunami, which came with along with a mudslide. And the governor flew in on a helicopter and saw the damage, and that's sort of what spurred this whole development.
So they had to resettle a whole village of people.
Yeah, and not just one village, but they also included 10 other communities from the surrounding area. There were basically less than 100 or sometimes less than 50 people in each one, but they've all come together, more than 400 families total who have sort of consolidated into this one city.
It's a very interesting idea. You just pick up all these communities and you create a new city with everything ready-made. Who came up with this idea?
Well, it started back in the late 80s and 90s with a guy named Esteban Moctezuma, who was the Secretary of Social Development in Mexico. And it was sort of a project, an idea that he had to bring together widely dispersed communities of poor people in poor states like Chiapas so that it would be easier to provide them with basic services like water and electricity. But he was never actually able to do it when he was in government. So two things happened that sort of gave the project more momentum. One was in 2000, the UN released their Millennium Development Goals. It's a wide range of initiatives and goals to sort of relieve poverty worldwide. And it includes things like increasing access to education for girls, reducing infant mortality rates, improving environmental sustainability. And so they decided to incorporate those goals into this city. And the other thing was obviously the flood. And so when the flood happened, Moctezuma went to the governor of Chiapas and proposed getting this project off the ground again. And they even went so far as to subsidize the entire thing and sort of collaborate with private foundations and provide them with everything they need at no cost.
You know, there's kind of an irony here in that this planned community with everything in it is being done in Chiapas, because Chiapas is actually the poorest state in an already very poor Mexico.
Exactly. That's what's surprising about it, is that it is in Chiapas, and it's an extremely poor state. But I think that's also the government's intent with this, is to sort of use Chiapas as an example, to say that, yes, these poor states can rise out of poverty, we can do something about this. And so they're sort of starting this project to say, hey, we can change things in Chiapas, and if we can do it there, then we can do it in other parts of Mexico too.
Help us get a feel for what a model city looks like. I mean, how do you create a model city? Take us there, if you would.
It is exactly like a model city. It's sort of like playing the game SimCity on your computer. You know, you sort of build this little subdivision where all the houses are exactly the same. It has several restaurants, a beauty parlor, a hardware store, a copy shop, the school, and the health clinic. There's another section where they have a carpentry shop, and a blacksmith, and a brick maker all next to each other.
It does sound like a game, or like Pleasantville or something.
Exactly. It's very sort of surreal walking around there.
So, Grant, you went to town, you spent a few days there and spoke with the people and filed a story for us. So let's listen to that now.
Okay, great.
Chiapas is full of water. Lakes, rivers, and waterfalls are everywhere. But for the residents of Nuevo Juan del Grijalva, this water is special. It's crystal clear. It's purified. It's not like the river water they were used to in the old village.
We used to have to run a long hose all the way down to the creek and take the water straight from there.
Ina Hernandez was a subsistence farmer before he moved here and started working at the water treatment plant. It sits on the highest point in this hilly town, so Hernandez enjoys a commanding view of a red brick sea of identical new homes below. This ultimate planned community, with rectangular backyards and smooth roads, could be mistaken for an American suburb at first. But the surrounding red dirt and bright green hillsides of rural Chiapas give it a look all its own. Up here on his water plant perch, Hernandez is clearly content with his new job.
It gives me a lot of pleasure and pride to be working here because I'm the one that lets people know it's clean water, to drink it with confidence.
Hernandez isn't the only one with a new life here. Ask anybody in this town what they used to do for a living, and you'll get the same answer every time.
Antes era campesino.
Allá pues, campesino.
Pues trabajaba en el campo.
I was a farmer, they all say. I planted corn, beans, and rice, took care of my livestock. Now, they've suddenly become bakers, butchers, and business owners. The government put Jose Arguye in charge of the local hardware store. So instead of working with farm equipment, he's selling household tools.
Era más difícil porque salía uno a las 6 de la mañana y regresaba uno a las 5.
It was harder before because I'd go out to the fields at 6 in the morning and come back at 5. And being out under the sun all day long, man, it's a tough job. But now that they gave me this hardware business, I'm here working under a roof. And after so many years working on the farm, I feel much better here now.
Just up the road from the hardware store, town brickmaker Misael Juarez watches as a worker pours a sandy mix into a tall machine. The man pulls a lever and a fresh, moist brick pops up. Later, they'll be sold to people who want to add on to their houses. Juarez has especially good reason to be grateful for a fresh start. 25 people died when the old village flooded 2 years ago.
Sí, se puede decir que sí, perdimos mucha familia. No perdimos la casa,
yes,
sino
we lost a lot of family. You could say we lost our way of life. But out there on our ranch, we didn't make any money and we couldn't get ahead. Clearly, this is a new life with a better income.
That kind of positive attitude is common in Nuevo Juan del Grijalva, even among the kids. At the new public school in the center of town, a third grade class shouts out answers during a history lesson. Outside, a class of 20 kids play a game with their phys ed teacher. When they lived in the old village, most of them had to travel by boat for hours to attend school. Some didn't go at all.
To tell you the truth, it's really nice here because now we get more education.
Carolina Diaz is 17. She was more than happy to leave behind the slow boat to school, and she loves her new life.
I'll never forget that river because some of my relatives died there. But everything is more civilized now, and one benefit is that it's easier to get things. Like if we want a kilo of rice or something, the Super Chiapas is right there, and before the market was far away from us.
The Super Chiapas Mini Mart on the main road does brisk business on this Tuesday morning. In a span of 5 minutes, eggs, pencils, chips, candy, and toothpaste fly off the shelves. Saul Juarez is the store manager here.
I'm happy because our place here is very busy. There are lots of people around. They're always passing by, and we're across from the school, so the children buy from me a lot.
Juarez makes $230 a month at the Super Chiapas, a fortune for a former campesino from the poorest state in Mexico. It's easy to get the sense that this place is perfect, but not everyone is adapting so well. Justina de Avidad misses the wide open spaces of her cattle ranch. She feels hemmed in by the identical government-built houses.
Claro, yo no me acostumbro porque pues.
I'm just not used to it yet. What happens is my mind starts to remember everything we had before, and I imagine myself living there.
It's totally different here, says Olga Suarez as she makes copies on the machine she recently learned how to use. She works in the town's office supply store. It's the first job she's ever had. For Suarez, the sudden presence of 1,000 neighbors has been a culture shock.
Well, over there we weren't used to living with so many people. We lived only with our family, so there weren't many of us around. And here, yeah, it's pretty crowded. We'll just have to get used to it.
And as for everyone making a good living around here, that's not quite happening either. At least not yet. Inside a hilltop factory, Martin Perez mixes ingredients in a big metal tub. He's making high-quality packaged cheese to be sold in Chiapas stores. Thanks to a new road the government built straight from town to the mountain highway, making shipments won't be such a problem. But like many businesses here, including a tomato greenhouse and a chicken farm, the cheese factory still isn't making the money the government hoped. So for now, Perez isn't doing much better than he did working on his farm.
But later on, I'll make more money. If this works and moves forward, we'll profit from it. And that's all we need to be able to get by and support our kids.
Those words of his, "if this works," are the key. Can this grand experiment actually sustain itself long term?
That's Grant Fuller reporting from Nueva Juan del Grijalva in Mexico. I asked Grant if there are any plans to create more of these ready-made rural cities.
Definitely. The plan was to start with this one and see how it works and then go forward from there and build more. So I believe there are at least 5 others that are currently in the planning process, if not construction already, in Chiapas. And then I think from there the plan is to expand on to other states and use this as an example in Mexico and perhaps for other countries as well.
And it's only been in existence for less than a year. So how's it working out so far? What did you think?
Just walking around there and talking to people, most are very happy with it. What is there not to be happy about, right? They're getting everything provided for them, free housing, free education, healthcare. It's a vastly different and better life than they were living before for most of them. But that said, it remains to be seen how this is going to actually work in the long term, if it's actually going to be sustainable, like they call it, a rural sustainable city.
Thank you so much, Grant, for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Peggy.
You can see photos of the relocated town on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, imagine Vogue magazine, Afghan style. We'll hear about a successful women's magazine next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Newspapers and magazines are having a tough time in this country. Magazines like Gourmet and Cosmo Girl have shut down. But in Kabul, the magazine business is thriving, especially one that's been created by women for women. Here's Will Everett from Afghanistan.
Mohammed Massoud sells magazines by a mosque. They hang like laundry on wash lines strung across his plywood kiosk. From the latest editions of Kabul's special interest weeklies to glossies from Iran and Saudi Arabia, already faded by the sun. One magazine stands out because of its bright pink border. Mohammed keeps it on a low shelf where it won't attract too much attention. He says that until last year he kept this one behind the counter, but when so many women started asking for it, he brought it out last year into plain sight. It's called Mursal, which means a kind of rose in the Dari language. It's Afghanistan's only magazine for women. Managing director and founder Najiba Ayubi strolls the walled compound where Mursal has its offices. She points to a glass enclosure running the length of one wall, where the covers of some 350 editions of the magazine, all 7 years worth, are on display.
Here is our magazines.
Oh, all the magazines?
Yeah.
Every issue?
Every issue, from beginning up to now.
The covers show women in head coverings doing things most women in the U.S. take for granted. Sitting in a classroom, voting, working at a job. But these activities were almost unheard of for women here before the fall of the Taliban. Ayubi says Mursal tries to keep women politically informed.
We have a one-page editorial. In this editorial, we try to have the hot matter in country. What is the hot topic in this time? We put in editorial.
But the magazine is also about more everyday issues.
This is not just politic. This is a social. This is for women and family. We try to have health, work, problems, education, everything about women.
The most recent issue features baking tips, choosing the best nail color, as well as skincare tips. But there's also an investigative piece on the murder of a female journalist in a Taliban-controlled region. Najiba says she wants to keep Mursal edgy without stirring up so much controversy that women are afraid to buy it. Today is Mursal's weekly deadline, and the newsroom is a beehive of activity. Women in headscarves sit behind computer monitors, anxiously making last-minute changes to stories. Each week, the magazine prints 15,000 issues. Ayubi estimates that each issue is passed along up to 10 times, giving it a readership of more than 100,000. She gets emails nearly every week from women who've made life-changing decisions because of the magazine, including those who've decided to go back to school. Ayubi says the magazine's emphasis on education has inspired something else. Nasty phone calls and letters, especially from the conservative South.
They ask me, why you did this? This is not the rule of media. Why do you did this? I say, this is the rule of media. You're wrong.
As for the Taliban, Ayubi says she's had little trouble from it, though she occasionally gets anonymous threats. When the magazine first started, someone threw a rock through her living room window with a note tied onto it. It said, we will kill you.
But it is not matter for me, because I choose this way. We have to do this.
The magazine's writers include 30-year-old Milav Nasiri. She edits stories to make sure the writing is simple and straightforward, since most of the readers have only rudimentary reading skills. But her real passion is investigative journalism.
I think my proudest story is the one I did on teenage women prisoners who were being raped by their guards. They were going into prison as single women and coming out with babies.
As I try to take her picture, she pulls her head covering down to make sure her face is completely hidden from view. When I ask her what she'd like to accomplish in her career, she seems unsure.
I just want the magazine to be able to run as it has been. I can't say I really have any big dreams beyond this. I just don't want anything to change. And in Afghanistan, you never know what will happen.
For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Kabul, Afghanistan.
It's not just magazines that are making it in Kabul. So is popular music. Music was banned under the Taliban, but it's making a big comeback. Here's popular Afghan singer Ali Edamadi. He's now based in Germany, and here's his latest song, Marie Basafa. خاکم بر سر فشاند و چون بادرد چشمم پر آب گشت و دلم پر آتش خاکم بر سر فشاند و چون بادرد میری به سفر ای دل بر من میری به سفر ای دل بر من میری به سفر داری تو خبر از حال دلم داری تو خبر داری تو خبر میری به سفر ای دل بر من میری به سفر ای دل بر من میری به سفر داری تو خبر از حال دلم داری تو خبر داری تو خبر. Anna Boyka Wyrock is a freelance reporter who's recently returned from a year in West Africa. In this reporter's notebook, she tells us about one of her biggest worries on the job.
When I showed up in West Africa, I thought I was set. I read up on the history, economy, language. I had 5 copies of my passport and 3 bottles of sunscreen. But pretty soon, I found one thing I didn't prepare for. Farm animals. In West Africa, livestock are an important part of life. They're not pets. They're food, work tools, and financial assets. But for me, they were a giant pain in the tuchus. Here's why. When I interviewed someone, usually we would sit outside on a bench in the shade. That's the most comfortable place when it's hot. But you can't control who comes to call. Like when I was speaking with a local women's group in Mali.
Et pourquoi elle ne...
Speaking French is hard enough. But it's even harder to communicate when a gaggle of guinea fowl decides to join in and ruin my recordings. I stop the interview and shoo them away.
Go away, go away, go away, go away.
Guinea fowl are noisy, funny-looking blue turkeys. But at least these particular ones graciously give us space. It's not always so easy, like those bulls in Burkina Faso. That's a country smack dab in the middle of West Africa, and one of the poorest in the world. I'm in a cotton field, and the farmer is really nice. He even demonstrates how to yoke his oxen to the plow. He puts metal rings through their noses and ties the rings together with rope. Then off they go. He starts to tell me about his farm. But just as the translator says the word cows, we hear something behind us. The farmer says, "Look out, look out!" His big gray bull is running helter-skelter across the field. Both cows are still attached at the nose. The other one trips and drags along the ground, hanging by the ring through his nostrils. Meanwhile, I cower in the corner of the field, holding my mic in a shaky hand. The farmer sends his children after the hulking oxen. But all the kids manage to do is dodge the careening feet and tails. Eventually, the cows calm down. It turns out one of the kids had been teasing the bull and spooked it. The farmer's mad and scolds his son. I get the interview back on track. The farmer tells me there's not enough rain. Fertilizer is expensive, and he makes a pittance from his crops. Sometimes, it's hard to get enough food for his large family. The thing is, his work would be impossible without the oxen. When I catch my breath, it's clear that my professional problems, roosters, guinea fowl, and even mad cows, are small in comparison.
Anna Boyko-Wyrock is a freelance reporter now based in Alabama. And that farmer you heard about in her report is just the kind of person who might apply for a microloan. Microloans have been a major tool in reducing poverty in recent years. The idea is to offer small loans, usually less than $100, to a poor person who wants to start a small business and who wouldn't qualify for a traditional bank loan. Microfinance got momentum and a lot of attention when Mohamed Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. Yunus had created the Grameen Bank to give loans to the poor in Bangladesh. Since then, microfinance has grown by leaps and bounds. But so too has the criticism that some organizations are taking advantage of the poor by charging them enormous interest rates and making a lot of money in the process. David Rudman is a research fellow at the Center for Global Development. He says microfinance has changed over the years.
That's right. The original impulse going back to the 1970s for doing microcredit, for making these really small loans to poor people, was to help them. And the people who originally did this were not in it to make money. But one of the amazing things about microcredit, and this really makes it different from most other sort of charitable projects, is this way it can pay for itself because people are willing to pay back the loans and pay back interest. So from the very beginning, it acquired this kind of business-like character where an organization with some seed money from a donor, whether it be a government or a private benefactor, could rather rapidly scale up to serve thousands and even millions of people. And over time, the vision developed of making it into a true kind of social enterprise where people would build these microcredit institutions that would be solid enough businesses that they could go to the capital markets and take loans and issue bonds and even issue equity, shares of stock, in return for a fraction of the profits. But as I've just implied, in order to go to the capital markets, they had to be willing to share their profits, and that meant that they had to switch from being non-profit to being for-profit. And, you know, there's always been a tension about whether this microfinance was losing its soul by going for-profit, but the counter-argument was that this way, microfinance could raise lots more money and grow even faster and serve more poor people.
And it did. How many people are getting microloans?
As a rough number, we can say 100 million.
100 million people.
Right. And that's up from zero in 1975, right? So that's a huge growth.
What is the normal interest rate for a microcredit loan? Is there an average interest rate?
There are some places where it's pretty cheap to do microcredit and other places where it's more expensive. Now, there are some groups that are charging upwards of 100%. And I think that is definitely a cause for concern. It is also the exception. So we shouldn't assume that all microcreditors are like that. The best numbers we have suggest that the median interest rate, that's the 50th percentile, on a global basis, is between 20 and 30%. So most microfinance institutions are actually not charging rates much higher than credit cards. The outliers, the ones that have really high interest rates, are mostly in Latin America, where the average rate is also higher. There's one called Compartamos, which ignited a huge controversy just over 3 years ago when it went public. And its founders became multimillionaires because of the shares that they sold. And that's profit that they made, you know, on the backs of very poor Mexican women. Not just profits, but profits on 100% interest. So that really seemed to be, you know, if anything is usury, that certainly seemed to be it. They have argued that by keeping their rates so high and their profits so high, they've attracted competition and accelerated, you know, the arrival of other microfinance institutions and the growth of the whole industry, which will, they say, in the long run, bring down interest rates through competition. And that has happened to some extent.
This isn't just a matter of greed?
It's not just a matter of greed, although there certainly is some of that going on, especially when the groups that are charging like 100%. They're certainly earning higher profits than they really need to.
We have heard so much about how microcredit is helping people start businesses and then be able to send their children to school or build a roof on their house. But at these interest rates, I wonder really if people are better off with microcredit, if they're having to pay this much interest. Does it help them or is it setting them back?
There are lots of stories of people climbing out of poverty through microcredit in the way you described. And I'm sure many of those stories are true. But I do believe at this point that they are exceptional. You know, if you gave loans to three of your friends, you know, one of them might spend it on beer, another one might start a business and it would fail, another one might start a business and it would succeed. You just got to figure that microcredit has different impacts on different people. The best studies we have, and there are very few good studies, suggest that the average impact on poverty is zero, at least over the short term, 1 to 2 years that have been studied so far.
Wait a minute. The average impact on poverty is zero, meaning these microloans are not helping at all?
Well, I didn't say that. And so I think there's a difference between getting out of poverty and sort of managing poverty, managing life in poverty. I think that credit can, and savings even more, can help people manage lives where they have low and unpredictable incomes. But I don't think it's routinely helping people out of poverty.
Really? So if you give a woman, say, a $250 loan and she's able to start a sewing business or a small bakery, and these are the kinds of stories I've heard about, and then she has business and she sells to her neighbors and she has money to send her kids to school, it seems like that is helping her out of poverty. Are these just fairy tale stories and don't happen as often?
I believe those are true stories, but they're just a few stories out of 100 million people that we're talking about here. What they won't tell you on the websites for the microfinance groups is about the women who start businesses that fail, right? Or the women who don't actually start a business at all, but do something else with the money in the ways that I've talked about, like sending their kids to school, which may be a very good thing, but doesn't fit into that fairy tale about lifting yourselves out of poverty through microenterprise.
And yet you mentioned there's still 100 million people getting loans. Where is this headed?
Well, your question kind of reminds me of a personal story. I spent some time a couple years ago really digging into the academic studies where they crunch the numbers and try to see whether microcredit reduces poverty. And I looked at a study where the answer was, yes, it does. And I dug into it in detail and tried to rerun all the mathematics that were in it to see if I believed it. And I began to come to the conclusion that I did not believe it. And I wasn't deciding that, microcredit is actually bad for people. I was just concluding that you couldn't answer the question either way with the data in this study. Now, while I was doing all this number crunching, I mean, really in the weeds and doing all this stuff on my computer, I visited several microcredit operations in Egypt and also in Bangladesh. And I remember in particular in Cairo, I visited a microfinance bank branch one day, and it was loan disbursement day. I mean, lots of women were going to get new loans. And the lobby was just jammed with women, and the crowd just spilled out into the hall and down to the stairs onto the street. There must have been hundreds there with their kids, and they were waiting for hours. And they seemed very happy and excited. And I thought, you know, should I tell these women that I've just, you know, crunched some numbers on my laptop back in the hotel room, and actually we're not so sure if this is a good idea, what you're doing? And I thought that would be absurd. Who am I to tell them how to live their lives, which I know very little about? And I feel like that paradox is really important to understand. On the one hand, we don't have a lot of academic quality evidence that it's lifting people out of poverty. On the other hand, you have to kind of respect the choices of 100 million people who are voluntarily using this service. There must be something good going on there. Maybe not in every case, but in a lot of cases.
David Rudman, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
David Rudman is a research fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. Most of us are familiar with a different kind of credit, the kind we get when we use that little plastic card in our wallets. That's the subject of this week's Globe at a Glance. These days, it's hard to associate credit card companies with anything beneficial, but American Express is trying to buck that trend. It's offering its cardholders rewards for good work. That's right, if you have an Amex card, the company will give you 500 reward points for every hour of community service you do. You can accumulate up to 10,000 points, or 20 hours of volunteer work, each year. Then you can spend those points on something you really want, like a handbag or a gardening tool, or you can donate the points to the charity of your choice. The company has teamed up with a social action network to run the program. They help match volunteers with community service organizations in their area. If you're an Amex cardholder, all you have to do is sign up for the program, go do the volunteer work, then log your hours on a special website. And voila, you've earned yourself some brownie points. That's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Coming up, we speak with Ruben Blades, singer and politician from Panama.
¿Qué pasó con esos guapos que alardeaban con su vida?
Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer.
El honor de nuestra esquina.
That's the voice of Latin superstar and award-winning actor Ruben Blades. He sang that song in the studio while we were interviewing him. It's from his latest album called Cantadas del Subdesarrollo, or Songs of Underdevelopment. That's an unusual title for an album. But Ruben Blades is no ordinary singer. For decades, he's combined music and politics. He even ran for president of his native Panama in 1994. And he's just finished a 5-year stint as Minister of Tourism. Ruben, I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thank you.
Some of your earliest songs covered stories about people we don't always hear about in salsa music. I'm thinking of Pablo Pueblo, a song which was one of your first hits. Let's listen to a bit of it, and then you can tell us what it's about.
Regresa un hombre en silencio, de su trabajo cansado. Su paso no lleva prisa, su sombra nunca lo alcanza. No espera el barrio de siempre, con el farol en la esquina. Con la basura ya enfrente, y el ruido de la cantina. Pablo Pueblo.
What are you singing about there, Ruben?
This is about a man returning from work to his room where he lives with his wife and his kids. And it's about the Latin everyday man working and trying to, hoping rather, that times will change and things will get better. It was a kind of song that wasn't being written at the time because I think the criteria was that music is basically a form of escapism and should not be used to confront or denounce or document aspects of our everyday life that are deemed to be hard or harsh or difficult.
Was there anything in particular that inspired you to kind of shift away from the traditional salsa and to write music and sing about the everyday man and his struggles.
It's very hard to pinpoint a specific reason. I mean, I had a grandmother who was a very special, enlightened woman who was taught me how to read when I was about 4 or 5. She lived in our house with my mother and my father. She had been a teacher. I think that the fact that she was always talking and expressing the need to change what was wrong was very influential in me. For instance, I decided to become a lawyer, which I did become, and I think a lot has to do with her, with Emma, and her struggles to get votes for the women and equal rights and racism. You know, I think that a lot of that had to inform me as from a very early age that there were things that needed to be examined and changed in society.
And you obviously used your music to speak to that. Some of your songs have protested the government or stood up for people who were ignored sometimes by the government in power. For the past 5 years, you made the switch to do something about that. Instead of singing about the problems in politics, you actually went into politics. You were the Panamanian Minister of Tourism. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little about that. Why did you make the switch?
Well, before that, I had created a political party in 1990. I ran for president of Panama in 1994, came in third out of 7 candidates and 26 political parties. And basically what I was trying to do was to make people aware that there are ways to change things. You're not really going to change the world by singing songs about other people's problems. It's one way to bring the issue up front and to make other people aware, but it's not going to be the way to effectively change Pablo Pueblo or the subject of my songs' lives. So that is why I decided again, and this time not run for president, but rather be a part of a government to go back to Panama and work under the presidency of Martin Torrijos, who was elected in from 2004. September 2004 to June 2009, I was working in the government, a part of the cabinet.
Yeah, you were Minister of Tourism. And how did you feel like you could help people on the ground in your country as a Minister of Tourism?
First of all, the fact that you resign your possibility of making money by singing, by doing shows, by doing albums, and by doing movies, and instead try to help your country and help others to get have an opportunity, that in itself is a very powerful example, I find.
You sent a strong message.
Well, at least to young people in Panama, that not everything is about Grammys or Oscars or money. You know, you're part of society, you do what you can to help the other guy. So I think that in itself was a message. That's why I stayed the 5 years. And during that time, I had no movies and then no more albums. Last albums I put out were Mundo, who won the Grammy for World Music in 2003, and that was it. So I think that in itself was an example that I think people believed because I stayed with it. The second thing is tourism creates the opportunity for the working class not only to have a job but to become themselves empresarios.
Can I interrupt just a second? What is an empresario?
A person that owns their own business. Entrepreneur. And this is important. When I was growing up, my mother used to tell me, Rubén, study so you can get a better job. My mother never said to me, study so you can own your own business. No one in our family, immediate family, was an empresario. And tourism can create empresarios out of the working class. It wasn't only very instrumental in diminishing the amount of unemployment in the women working group, because by creating more hotels and more tourist-related activities that cater a lot to the domestic type of work, women who didn't necessarily have other type of education that would allow them to go to a different sector. The other thing that was important was that it created the opportunity for guides, for restaurants, for car transportation, for a tremendous amount of the opportunities for the small and middle working business people.
Were you able to really increase tourism and did the number of jobs rise under your role as Minister of Tourism?
Yeah, as part of the whole government, yes, the numbers are there for anyone who wants to examine them. I mean, but the most important thing also was that it happened on a national scale. In the past, most of the efforts were made in the city, which is where the power resides. We tried to create a national plan, which we did. We created the first national tourism law, the first program for tourist development that would not destroy nature nor culture. And we made it a national proposal so that all of a sudden people in Chiriquí, in Veraguas, in different provinces of Panama could develop themselves there without having to travel to the city to try to find a job. I tell you, a lot of people come out of government disillusioned. I did not. I came out knowing that the system can work.
Oftentimes in tourism, we see these large multinational hotel chains coming in, making a lot of money, paying minimum wage, and taking the money out of the country. As in your role as tourism minister, did you do anything to change that? And did the tourism dollars trickle down more to the locals who worked in these places?
It is happening slowly because we're not encouraging type of Cancun type of development. Our position was that we should concentrate on nature and culture. And for that, instead of trying to go after the large numbers of people, we were more encouraging mom-and-pop type of operations and smaller type of developments.
Ruben, I'd like to go back to your music for a minute. After 5 years away in the government, your fans are really happy to hear you singing and playing again. And your new album is called Songs of Underdevelopment. That's at least the English translation. What did you mean by that? That's an interesting title.
It's just a way, you know, the so-called third world. I used it as sarcastically, basically. Songs from the underdevelopment.
Yeah, let's listen to the very first song, then. The first song reflects the themes that we've been discussing. It's called Las Calles, or The Streets. Let's listen to that.
Las calles de nuestros barrios nunca toman prisioneros. Quiebran al que no resiste, sea local o sea extranjero. Ay, la paciencia no existe.
What's this song about, Ruben?
The song really reflects the opinions of two generations. The first part, which is two voices, it's a young guy is saying what the streets are like, that they don't forgive, that they don't take prisoners, etc. And then the lone voice that responds is one of the old-timers that says, you know, whatever happened to all those guys who were so full of themselves, you know, they end up dishonoring the corner and we just threw him out. And then all of them join and sing and say, in their streets, death and life dance together, holding a can of beer in their hands. Basically, it's just telling you solidarity is important and life depends on it.
And your second song is called Portable Country. I'd like to listen to a bit of that.
Castiga al que es honrado y a un pueblo autocondenado por no aceptar la verdad. Se vende un país portátil, se ofrece en partes o entero con un préstamo extranjero. Hacerlo andar.
What are you singing about here in Portable Country?
Basically, what I'm trying to do is reflect the responsibility that people have on corruption, on political corruption. Countries are not born poor. They are made poor. And poverty is not just something that you measure by economic indexes. There is also the poverty of spirit, of intellect, of will. And every single time I hear talk about corruption, it's only reflected on politicians as if the rest, the private sector, was immaculate. And what I'm saying is we all have responsibility in what is happening. The corruption of the public official is encouraged by the private sector's apathy and or active bribes. And that's what this song is about. The country becomes a portable country, meaning it's for sale because people allowed it to be sold. If you don't sell yourself, no one will buy you.
So it sounds, Ruben, like you've come to a place where you've really meshed your political interests and your music. But you were saying earlier in the interview that you left music because you felt like the music might have made people aware, but in politics you could actually do something. So I'm wondering, now that you're back in music, looking back, which venue do you feel gives you the most influence for change?
Politics, because there are effects. I mean, you can have an effect on politics in every field.
So will you go back into politics? But you're back in music full time.
It depends. I need to. I think in different ways, and I move in different directions. It's only going to the possibility of me becoming active again in politics is going to depend on the degree of responsibility that I can find existing in my country at that time.
Would you run for president again?
I don't know if that is something that is going to happen. I don't know if that is in the cards, but I certainly, like I said before, you never know in what capacity you're going to serve. Everyone is important.
Why don't we close, Ruben, with a song from the album that you recommend? What would you like for us to hear?
Well, I got to say, I like the whole record. But Símbolo, Panama, the one version Panama, Símbolo, that's a good one.
Let's play that then. Ruben Blades, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Peggy. Thank you very, very much for this opportunity.
Ruben Blades is a Grammy-winning singer and actor, and until recently, Panama's Minister of Tourism. To hear more of his music, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. We've just heard from a musician slash politician, and now we hear from a reporter slash poet. We're talking about our very own Grant Fuller, who spent nearly 2 years living in West Africa. While he was there, Grant traveled around using every means available, taxi, bus, boat, and train. He ended up with a healthy appreciation for the patience and perseverance of West Africans. Here's Grant's ode to the West African traveler.
The West African road is not easy. But you always take it in stride. These bumps would make mortal men queasy. They say public transport is suicide. With five adults and a goat in the back, you argue politics. Soon, there's a flat to fix. You volunteer to operate the jack.
No guy came, their first time to come on the quota, it was February 15th.
Windows down on a newly paved road, you want to reminisce about bad times, about the disrespect the rebels showed, a president now accused of war crimes. Your feet dangle off the front of a train, drifting off to sleep, got no schedule to keep, palm wine is all you need to stay sane. In the desert, a bus with no AC. I wonder how you endure this sweat box. At the rest stop, boys beg for your money. You toss a coin because you know hard knocks. Your engine might die. You just shrug, you sigh. Another breakdown on the highway. Oh well, this is Africa, you say.
Grant sent us some very poetic photos of his travels. You can see them on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And that's where we end our show today. We invite you to take a look at our website this week. And remember, if you want to take us with you, you can just download a podcast from worldvisionreport.org or from iTunes. The program was produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the organization.